He swings his leg out of the bed and begins to put on his clothes, attempting to comport himself as though nothing is out of the ordinary. Hallie props herself on her elbows, squinting against the day.
Are you going out?
In the morning light, her bare breasts are like silver apples, the fruit of a fairy tale land already disappearing out of his reach.
Oh yeah, did I not say? I promised I'd go and talk to Greg about the program notes for this concert of his.
But it's Saturday.
She rubs her nose.
And it's the holidays.
Howard shrugs woodenly.
You know what he's like. Everything has to be just right.
Okay.
She yawns, drawing the covers back up over her, claiming his abandoned share too. Her voice is muffled by eiderdown.
I think it's good the way you're taking part in school activities more.
Yeah, well, you get out what you put in, don't you?
Howard buttons up his coat.
I shouldn't be too long. Keep a spot for me.
He winks at her as he passes through the door, realizing as he does so that this is the first time he has winked in the whole span of their relationship. The roads are eerily deserted, as though they have been cleared by decree to hasten his journey. A single car, Greg's, waits in the school car park. Inside, the empty classrooms and corridors seem nothing more than an elaborate facade, a huge Byzantine foyer to the single occupied room. Mounting the stairs, every footstep clangorously echoing, Howard feels like some unfortunate in a Greek myth sent to do battle with the Minotaur. Outside the principal's office, on the bench known to generations as Death Row, Howard finds the lone figure of Brian Jeekers Prendergast. He is chewing his nails and has a stranded look about him, as though he's been here for centuries, some minor fixture in a legend.
Mr. Costigan in there?
Howard points to the door, but before the boy can even reply, a voice comes booming from within.
Get in here, Howard!
Howard finds the automator poised pugilistically in the dead center of the room, as though ready to defend it against all comers. He is in his weekend wear, pale blue cotton shirt with a yellow sweater slung over the shoulders, beige slacks, and brown hush puppies. It looks totally incongruous, like Godzilla in sweatpants.
I'm afraid he's in a meeting at the moment. May I take a message?
Trudy, phone trapped between cheek and shoulder, leans and writes a name at the end of a list of names on the desk.
Yes, we think a tummy bug is going round. Thank you. He'll call you later this morning.
Damn it!
The automator mutters, pacing back and forth, scratching his jaw, and then raising his voice.
Well, damn it, Howard. Sit down, man.
Obediently, Howard seats himself on the other side of the desk from Trudy. The transformation in train on his last visit is now nearly complete. The high-backed African chairs have been replaced by ergonomic office models, and the aquarium by the door, where the multicolored fish continues serenely to drift, oblivious to the changes, is now the only reminder of the room's previous incumbent.
Would you like anything, Howard?
Trudy whispers solicitously.
Tea, coffee, juice.
Damn it, Trudy, don't offer him juice. We have a very serious situation here.
Yes, dear.
She apologizes, setting down the phone, which immediately begins to ring again.
Hello, acting principal's office.
Damn it.
The automator repeats preparatorially, like a chainsaw warming up, and then, in a louder voice.
Howard, what the hell... I mean, what in the name of God?
Howard begins.
In all my days as an educator, never once, not once, have I witnessed anything that comes close to what I saw last night. Not once. Damn it. Damn it, I put you in charge. Didn't I give you strict instructions as to... I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, one of those instructions wasn't to let the thing descend into a Roman orgy, was it?
No.
You're damn right it wasn't. And yet here we are, with this on our hands.
He points to the phone.
parents ringing me all morning, wanting to know why little Johnny came home from an official supervised school hop covered in puke and even more slack-jawed than usual. What do you think I should tell them, Howard? You should have seen the shape he was in a half hour before. God damn it! Do you have any clue what kind of a mess you've dropped us into here? I mean, what the hell happened in there? You don't know. Of course, nobody knows. It's the Bermuda Triangle. Well, let me tell you something, Howard. Somebody knows. And when I find out, believe me, heads are going to roll. Because if those people...
Pointing to the phone again.
My God, if they had any idea what actually happened...
He grasps at his hair, pacing back and forth, distractedly, like a deranged pastel-clad robot. Then, taking a deep breath, comes to a stop in front of Howard.
Okay. I suppose we're not going to get anywhere by flying off the handle. I'm not trying to pin this whole thing on you. All I'm looking for is an explanation. So you just tell me, in your own words, exactly what you saw last night.
He folds his arms and settles back against the sideboard, a vein twitching furiously in his forehead. 12 hours ago, Howard was lying supine on the teacher's desk in the geography room. From the wall, the happy miners of the Rhine-Ruhr Valley grinned down at him, and looking back up at them, his head tilting back into empty space, Howard was half-dreaming he'd fallen down a mineshaft. Or was it a trench? Could they be soldiers, faces blackened for night patrol? On top of him lay Miss McIntyre, her hands folded into him, her hair spilling over the floodplain of his chest, the borders of their bodies porous, liquid, indeterminate. The storm thundered at the window. Intermittently, the room lit up with flashes of lightning so quick you couldn't be sure you hadn't imagined them. The last dregs of satiety buzzed through his blood like fortified wine. And then, with a sharp intake of breath, he felt her body stiffen against his, and before he could ask her what was wrong, he felt it too, the same irrefutable chill. The drumbeat hit them as soon as they left the room, still scrabbling for buttons and zippers, and grew louder with every breathless hastening step down the deserted halls. Outside the door to the gym they found Wallace Willis, the hop DJ, trembling from head to foot, with a look of grubby, tear-stained distress, like he'd spent 3 days locked in a drain.
"They're playing the wrong songs,"
was all that he would say. When they opened the gym door, the music was so deafening that for a moment it precluded any other sensation. But only for a moment. And then the full horror of the situation was upon them. Discarded costumes strewed the floor. A Viking helmet, a gilt-trimmed bustier, a pirate's eye patch, a pair of butterfly wings, as well as more conventional items such as trousers, t-shirts, stockings, and undergarments, all lay blithely crushed beneath the feet of former wearers as they rocked in the bare flesh of each other's arms. Somehow, the invisible barriers separating them at the start of the night had come crashing down. Goths were with jocks, dweebs with bimbos, studs with skanks, blimps with waifs. Everyone was with everyone, indistinguishable, propping each other up or collapsed in nearly naked heaps, as if the germ of Howard and Aurelie's secret moment in the geography room had been caught by an internal breeze and, as in some nightmarish morality tale, blown down here, where in the hothouse atmosphere it had grown 10 feet tall and spread like a weed over everything, so that now wherever they looked they saw it reproduced in monstrous, magnified form, stripped in the lurid circus colours of the lights, of everything but mindless carnality.
"Oh, my God,"
Miss McIntyre crooned, in a voice cracking with self-disgust. Howard tried to think of something comforting or exculpating or purposeful to say, but found nothing. The two of them did their best to restore order. But the kids simply didn't listen. It wasn't defiance. Rather, they seemed in a kind of erotic trance. They would stare, moon-eyed, at Howard, as he wagged his finger in their faces, threaten them with suspension, letters home, police, and then, as soon as he had turned his back, resume whatever it was he had interrupted.
"This is hopeless,"
Miss McIntyre exclaimed, at the brink of tears.
"Well, what do you suggest we do?"
Howard said, feverishly gathering up a long coil of toilet paper, at the end of which a priapic mummy was groping the breasts of a girl, who, although standing upright, appeared to be asleep, a rainbowed shiver of fabric, once a mermaid's tail, lying bald at her feet.
"Stop that!"
He bundled the toilet paper into the mummy's hands.
"Here, cover yourself up, for God's sake!"
"We have to call Greg,"
Miss McIntyre said.
"Are you out of your mind?"
"We have to get away from me!"
Leaping with a wail from the extended paws of a mysterious pink rabbit.
"Surely we don't need to involve him,"
Howard pleaded, though all the evidence pointed to the opposite. But it was academic, because somehow the automator was already there in the doorway. For a moment, he did not move from it, looking on stony-faced as Dennis Hoey, shirt unbuttoned, tie flung back over his shoulder, staggered by him, flapping his arms and raving hoarsely,
"Study your shirt sleeves! Tuck in those notes!"
And over the PA, a gangster rapped,
"I chop off your head, bitch, and jizz on your grave!"
Then he swung into action, striding onto the dance floor, sundering any couples he encountered by grabbing both parties by the neck and literally flinging them in opposite directions. The acting principal cut a path to the wall-mounted fuse box. Of course. Why hadn't Howard thought of that? Abruptly, the music ceased. A moment later, the house lights came up, and all but the most abandoned of the revelers paused, blinked, murmured to themselves uncertainly.
"All right,"
the automator bellowed over their heads.
"I want everyone lined up against that wall this minute."
The effect was not immediate, but some dim ember in their minds recognized his voice, and gradually they began to obey, stumbling and ragged in the bright light. In 5 minutes, they were marshaled into a row, those not capable of standing, kneeling or squatting on the floor, all gazing at the automator with stuporous, unfocused eyes. For a time, he did nothing but stare, as if his fury was such he could not trust himself to speak. Then finally he said,
"I don't know what's got into you people tonight, but let me assure you of this. There are going to be repercussions. Serious repercussions."
Standing at his left hand, Howard cringed interiorly.
"It is now,"
the automator flourished his watch,
"exactly 22:33:30. In 26.5 minutes, at 2300 hours, I am going to open those double doors, and you are going to proceed directly to your parent or guardian. None of you will mention any aspect of what transpired here. If they ask, you will say that you had fun. But now you are feeling tired and would like to go to bed. Good night. What will you say?
Have fun, tired. Good night."
The zombified horde mumbled piteously.
"Good. In a moment, I'm going to direct you to put on your clothes. At my word, I want you in blocks of 10, starting at this end with you, giant ant, to make your way in an orderly fashion to your costume. In the event that you cannot find your..."
He stopped. Near the door, a very thin girl, dressed only in an olive drab brassiere and khaki cut-offs, had stumbled out of the line, clutching her stomach.
"At my word, missy."
But the girl paid no attention. Instead, doubled up, she emitted a long, painful moan. There was a loud shuffling noise as her 200 peers adjusted their position to get a better look. The girl coughed delicately, as though about to make an announcement, and then, After a moment at once infinitely prolonged and inexorably doomed, the inevitable multicolored torrent came gushing from her mouth.